from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1992, MIT grad student Eric Brindy committed himself to living a year off the grid. No phone, no computer, no refrigerator, no electricity. He and his new wife, Mary, embarked on a kind of forward-to-the-past adventure, settling in with a community of people he calls the Minimites, a little bit Amish, a little bit Mennonite, all about avoiding technology. Eric and Mary went 18 months with their experiment and came out changed. 10 years later, Eric Brindy continues to live in a world as technology-free as he can make it. The surprising discovery for the rest of us, he says, is that the people up at dawn working with their hands on the farm have more leisure time than the plugged-in, technology-charged folks working 9 to 5. And it is time-saving technology itself, he concludes, that often robs people's free time, people's human freedom. Tonight on Point, reassessing the technology age life from off the grid. Also, later in this hour, we'll talk with 9/11 Commissioner Jamie Gorelick on President Bush's proposal for intelligence reform and her reflections on the testimony of key players before the commission, including Condoleezza Rice and Richard Clark. But first, one young couple's adventure off the grid. Can you imagine unplugging from nearly every machine in your life? Your laptop, your cell phone, your BlackBerry, your washing machine. Does that sound like liberation to you? Have we become slaves to technology? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from St. Louis is Eric Brindy. He walked away from MIT and into a bearded, buggy-driving Midwestern community of what he calls Minimites. He came back with a new philosophy and now a new book titled Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology. Good evening and welcome, Eric Brindy.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us. So paint a picture for us. Where were you where was your thinking in the early 90s when you decided to go off and sample the switched-off life for what turned out to be 18 months?
Well, you have to understand that my thinking had been developing for a number of years, from probably my early undergraduate days or even before that. Just as I gradually became aware of the heretical thought, as you put it, that really our labor-saving devices are creating more labor than they save, and our time-saving devices likewise. And the reason I say that and what was dawning on me was that these devices so often, and I'm concentrating mostly on the automatic equipment, the motorized equipment, they so often deprive us of exercise and ordinary social and mental challenges that we just need to be healthy and alive. And if you do that, all you've done is postpone the day when you must meet those challenges. And so the self-imposed exercise regimen or quality time that we have to carve out of our busy schedules to spend with family members or hobbies that we create on the side to make up for what technology took away from us. And to me, that explained a lot of why society seemed to be becoming a rat race and why people so often complain with all of these time-saving devices around them that they have no time. And so I came to MIT with a kind of a mission. I guess it was subversive. And luckily, it led into this adventure.
The adventure that unfolds in an undisclosed location. You won't tell us exactly where it was. And in a kind of an unusual community, not pure Amish, not pure Mennonite, a kind of a melange, some of each of those and others. We want to get to the philosophy you developed out of all this, but take us into the community that you connected with somewhere in the Midwest. How did you come into such a community we imagine would be pretty closed? And what did you find when you got there?
It was very serendipitous. It was on one of my bus trips back from MIT. And I, by the way, I decided to take the bus because it was more low-tech than the plane. And the time I took this bus, I remember distinctly that the plane was the same price due to an airfare war. So it was a little bit grating for me to shell out the same amount of bucks. But
Toe-dipping already. You were headed home to Topeka, Kansas, your hometown.
Right, yes. And I just wanted to experience the transition of the countryside gradually and not just suddenly pop back into a different environment, which I always, it always took me a couple of days to get back into the swing of things anyway, whenever I did that. So, but luckily or serendipitously, somewhere around Pittsburgh, and I'm not necessarily giving a clue as to the location of the community
here. All right. Though it doesn't seem to be in the Pennsylvania Dutch country, from what I read here anyway.
You might be reading correctly. A man with a big black hat got on the bus, and I was very curious. And, of course, with my way of thinking, I wanted to know more about what made this man tick. So I approached him and struck up a conversation. I was a little bit afraid he might be standoffish, but he was really quite friendly, and he seemed to be eager to chat. And one thing led to another. Got his address, and later in the semester, I wrote him a letter, and he set something up for me.
And you ended up taking off for that something with a new bride, Mary, and moving into a little house in the countryside in the midst of a community. You were hardly the only house in this community, renting from a fairly Amish or Mennonite kind of landlord, a house with no electricity, electricity which you did not choose to use, and in the midst of a culture that was, the farthest thing from a high-tech culture.
Right, and in fact, what it really intrigued me about this community when I first met the man on the bus is that he informed me that they didn't allow motors of any kind. And I happen to know from what little experience I had with the Amish so far is that most Amish groups allow all kinds of motors. The only motors they don't allow are motor vehicles or motors within vehicles. So they have chainsaws and pumps and stationary farming equipment. And even in the household now, they have all kinds of appliances run by air pressure devices.
This wasn't your community, adopted community, but this is Amish in many parts of the country.
Yes. So this community, this guy was telling me about a community that didn't have any motors. And I thought, wow, this is a find. It's very rare to come across a community like that.
And there you are. You weren't really experienced in farming or anything of the kind, and yet you had to make do with none of our modern conveniences.
Yes, yeah. We did have kind of a double burden because not only did we have to have less technology, well, of course, it wasn't a burden if my philosophy is right, but we did also have the steep learning curve to face as neophytes in the farming community.
So within a few pages, you're rhapsodizing about the joys of hoeing a long line of beans or shelling peas for hours on end or lots of other kinds of pretty tough labor. And here's where I'm trying to understand exactly where you're coming from. You know, I grew up in a community that had a pretty strong Mennonite influence. I've sat around with Mennonite ladies in black bonnets shelling peas for hours on end, done a lot of hard physical labor. You know, and I know an awful lot of people flee those communities in part because of that labor or the allure of technology. How did you see yourself going back to it being so drawn to it?
Well, I think you do have to make a distinction between the potential to save labor with less technology and the actual state of affairs in a given Amish community. I know that there are Amish communities, and I know this is true in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, where work is enshrined as the highest ideal, and people can almost work themselves into a tizzy there to keep up. And that is not necessarily always the case, but that is often the case in some of these communities. In the community where we were, I would say that there was a sizable group within the community, not necessarily everyone, but a sizable group whose goal was quite different, whose goal was to slow the pace of life and to live with the least amount they needed necessary and to have ample leisure time either to reflect or simply to enjoy nature.
And you described that as, or I guess they called it, slow time as opposed to fast time. What was it that you felt unfolding during that experience in that quasi-Amish community? What was the change brought to your frame of mind, to your experience of living?
Well, I do think that the fundamental change is the manual labor itself, paradoxically, because it takes, because there's this heft to it. It's like chewing a whole wheat bread or multi-grain bread, it's a little bit harder to chew. It takes a little longer. So you stretch out the meal in the case of bread. And in this case, what the labor does is it slows down the pace and it creates maybe what in music would be the equivalent of an obbligato, kind of a melodic undercurrent that's an accompaniment for the melody. So you have this one layer of activity. It slows you down, the manual labor. And then on top of that are layered other things that take place. If you're working with other people, you have conversation. You have this esprit de corps. You hear the birds chirping. You feel the breeze. And it really is a symphony of experiences all blended together. And it's quite indescribable when you step into this world. It's suddenly, well, not suddenly, gradually you become aware that there is a whole three-dimensional existence outside of this almost two-dimensional existence that we have when we sit in front of a screen, be it the TV screen or the computer screen or the windshield of a car, where you're just doing this one activity that's a single-dimensional, I would call.
And as I read you, Eric Brindy, in the process of all this, I don't know if it's fair to call you to say you became a Luddite, but you ended up with some appreciation of Mr. Ludd back in the early 19th century. What's the critique you're making then of the life that's not that physical labor, close to nature life?
Well, let me say that I sympathize with Ludd, but I don't advocate his measures of going and smashing technology. I think that's counterproductive. But I do think that there was a gross injustice way back when all of these textile machines were displacing the skilled labor and a whole culture that went with it of the weavers. And I guess my philosophy that develops is, of course, that the best political philosophy is a change in personal lifestyle. And to try to implement what I learned among the people I call the Minimites, I've simply tried to minimize the amount of labor-saving, especially automated or motorized equipment that I use in my life, in order to maximize the amount of three-dimensional, I'd say layered kinds of experiences we have. You have blend together exercise and sociability or what have you.
10 years on, you drive a rickshaw in St. Louis and make soap. Is that evidence that you've managed to stick with the program? And how do you look to your neighbors in doing that? Like a pioneer or a slacker?
Well, that's an interesting question. I do think that it's very much evidence that we've been able to implement to a large extent the kinds of principles that we saw in evidence there in the community. And I think the pace of our life is very, very nice and slow, and it's rich. And as for our neighbors, I think that you get a whole range of reactions. On the whole, I think people are curious in a positive sense. It's very new to see a neighbor driving by in a rickshaw, but it's intriguing. And especially in the neighborhood that we live in, St. Louis, when we first moved in, I almost had to bat the kids off as they tried to climb on my rickshaw as I was going off to work. They all wanted to ride, so children especially are intriguing. I found that also with the lawnmower, the old-fashioned reel mower.
Mm-hmm.
The kids ask you if they can mow your yard. They don't even want to be paid. They're so fascinated by it.
They don't ask when it's got a roaring motor on the top.
Well, no, not that I know of. I don't have one, though.
Eric Brindy, we've got to take a break, but here we are. It's August. Everybody's thinking about what they're doing and not doing with their lives, the pace that they're living and not living with their lives. We're talking about going off the grid, about one young couple's journey away from the high-tech life we lead. My guest is Eric Brindy. He's author of the new book, Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology. You can join our conversation tonight as you head off on vacation with your cell phone and your laptop and your BlackBerry. Are you thinking there has to be a better, a simpler way? Do you buy the argument that technology enslaves as much as it liberates? Have you ever dreamed of going Amish, or does that sound absurd? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Eric Brindy about his new book, Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology. For 18 months, he lived without electricity in a community of people related to the Amish that he calls Minimites. You can join our conversation tonight. Is it possible that our labor-saving devices have denied us something vital about physical labor and its satisfactions? Is Eric Brindy looking backward or ahead? And which technology would you give up first? Your car, your phone, your TV, or do you want it all? Can we have technology and a soulful life? Are they mutually exclusive? A new reality TV series, Amish in the City, features five men and women who grew up Amish and are now living with six roommates from different backgrounds in a house in the Hollywood Hills. Here are clips from interviews with three of the Amish participants, Mose, Ruth, and Miriam, about their low-technology upbringing.
It's actually a very good lifestyle. I like the morals and lifestyle a lot that the Amish teach. So I have no problem with the fact that I grew up Amish and everything, and it's a really simple, modest, humble lifestyle.
Usually because I was the oldest girl in the family, you had to, you know, do what your mom did because she would teach you first before anybody else. Well, I was doing laundry, I baked, I cooked, I worked on the farm, I just swept, sewed clothes, and just a lot of different stuff.
A lot of people think that I, you know, because I'm Amish, that I've never seen anything. Like, I've never seen a car or TV or anything like that. And they're wrong. You know, we do see that stuff.
Mose, Ruth, and Miriam from Amish in the City. Our guest, Eric Brindy, was non-Amish in the country. Paul is calling from Hollis, New Hampshire. Hi, Paula. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, you're making me very homesick. I lived for 3 years on a mountainside in Mallorca without anything, basically, as well, and I miss it terribly.
What about it exactly, Paula?
Well, I mean,
it sounds pretty great, but was it really without anything? Was it really off the technology grid?
Absolutely. I didn't know how to even turn a computer on. I still don't know how to work TV and the controls or anything like that. I don't know how to take a message off the telephone. I don't want to know either. I really don't like it. I miss it terribly.
And what exactly is it that you're missing about that, Paula?
Well,
now you've got access to the internet and the automobiles and the, you know, the refrigerator, washer, dryer, all the rest.
Yeah. I used to wash my clothes in a bucket, and they got air dried whenever. I had no TV. I had no central heating. I had no light. I will admit, I like to read at night, and I ruin my eyes using candles. But I was basically up with the sun and bed with the sun, and I'd maybe have an hour nap in the afternoon.
And what did you find in that experience that you're not finding in the American, something more like the mainstream now?
I had time. I had an acuteness of vision. It was more than just eyes. It was everything. I was just so in tune. You mentioned hearing the birds. Yes, I would hear the first. He would wake me every morning, a little tiny finch, and then I would be outside working, and there'd be the cry of the hawk. I'd be walking, and I would notice the dust rising up under my feet and look down, and I'd see a rhinoceros beetle climbing, you know, crawling around down there. I could hear the trees talking. They hummed, and the lights that were shining off of the little crystalline things in the rocks were speaking and singing, and the sun and the sunrise and the clouds.
We've got it, and we're about to be swept away in the poetry. But can you imagine Americans living that way in their millions today, Paula? Can you imagine a realistic scenario for people having more of that in their contemporary lives?
Well, you're not going to probably like this answer, but I think Americans had better get used to the idea of doing it, because the way things are going now, either global warming or a war is going to get us, and we're going to be thrown back into this Eden, is what I think, actually.
Paula, we've got it, and thank you very much for your call. Eric, I wanted to ask you the same question, this kind of pastoral life you described. Do you see it as the past or as one way or another the American future in some respect?
Well, I think it's strange to look at it on some kind of linear timeline. I think that you've had ages, both in the past and potentially in the future, where life was balanced or can be balanced, and we have ages when life is discordant. I personally, in St. Louis, have to say that I think it's entirely feasible. And it helps that St. Louis is a very livable city. It's very inexpensive compared to other major cities. Actually, I read somewhere recently that it's the fifth cheapest major city in the United States. And yet it has, in my opinion, the cultural amenities of Boston.
But you're giving rickshaw rides to somebody. You're selling soap to somebody for a while. I don't know if you still had a bed and breakfast that you're advertising on the Internet. Are you, in effect, as you live a low-tech lifestyle, depending on an economy that's generated by high-tech plugged-in people elsewhere?
Well, yes, but that is the situation in which I find myself, that most people are that way. If people gradually change, then my economic practices may change as well. But I think that the economy is simply the net result of all kinds of individual economic transactions that everybody makes with each other, and we adapt as these conditions change.
So individual decisions, and off we go, maybe to a different future. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jerry's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi there. You just sort of brought up the point that I wanted to make, which is that I've thought about this myself a lot, about simplifying my life and sort of getting off the grid, and I realize that there are a lot of things I depend upon that are a product of modern technological societies, in particular things like medical care, and a lot of industrially manufactured things like nails and tools and sorts of things that you'd find it pretty difficult to do without those. So to me, it's sort of an interesting balancing act of how can you create a society that is, on the one hand, simpler and allows people to live the way that your guest is living, and at the same time can provide those sorts of manufactured goods that provide that make that sort of easier and make
yeah.
it have a better chance of, you know, decent life expectancies and that sort of thing.
Eric Brandy, speak directly to Jerry on that. What do you say?
Well, I don't think we're in danger of suddenly having shortages of nails at this point. I think we're facing the opposite danger, that we're going to be engulfed by technology if we don't start scaling back. And if it tips to the other extreme, I would be quite surprised and maybe a little gratified that I would have such an impact, or that these kinds of ideas would have such an impact that we'd have to even veer back again to the middle. I just don't think that that's what we face right now.
Jerry, what about it? Maybe it's a dichotomy we don't need to draw. Maybe there's so much material abundance that's not the issue, or not yet.
That's kind of my point, is that there has to be a way to work out a balance, because I certainly wouldn't want to go back to the Stone Age. On the other hand, if you do depend on manufactured goods, you're relying on somebody to live a life that's not the kind of life that you're describing. And maybe that's fine. Different people like different things.
Maybe a society marbled through with some of each. Jerry, thanks a lot for your call. Sharon is calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Sharon. You're on the air.
Hi. I just finished your book a couple of days ago. And one of the questions that I had was more about your research in writing the book. When I was reading it, it seemed that you guys did give back to the community that you lived in. But in some ways, it seemed like you took more than you gave. And I was wondering if you can speak to that.
Oh, it's a great question, Sharon. Eric Brandy, I wish you'd lay out some of the illustrations of what Sharon's talking about. There were many times when your hinder was saved by the more experienced Amish and Mennonite folks around you. Describe some of those for us.
Well, yeah, you're right. We were very much in their debt, and it was almost an act of charity, I think, for them to allow us to stay with them. And I think they had to suppress giggles on many occasions as we floundered around and flopped around and made idiots of ourselves. But I think it's entirely consistent with their philosophy or their theology. One of the points that the minister made in the sermon that I described is that it was their duty to help the blind and the lame and not to cast them aside. And I think that in a way we fit the bill for that, that we were objects of somewhat of charity. But I think as we got a little better, a little more experienced, I think it became more mutual. Part of the way through our time there, my host started using me to do jobs around his farm and things that, you know, he needed done. And he was glad to trade rent for these services that I provided. And he seemed pleased with what I did. So at that point, I think we were starting to hold our own a little more.
Sharon, how did you see it? Reading Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology, did you see Eric and Mary in this quasi-Amish community as giving back enough or as voyeurs, as freeloaders?
I wouldn't say freeloaders. That's kind of a strong term. But part of the problem, I think, when you go out and do research and kind of in an ethnological kind of a way, you do end up taking more than you give sometimes. And what kind of mark do you leave on the community when you've left? Like, I was curious how the Millers felt when their son got a ride in the car.
This was the landlord, who you came to know very well, Eric.
Right, and he's saying, "Oh, gee, can I have a ride in the car?" And you go, "Yeah." And it's like, well, what did his dad think of that?
We'll get a
community that's non-technological, and
right.
Somebody comes in from the outside.
In fairness, I didn't see Eric spraying a lot of technology around that, and we'll go to that. But Sharon, let me ask you first: how could someone? Are you suggesting that someone from outside who doesn't have all the skills in simple agriculture and physical labor that this community had, that they shouldn't even come because they inevitably take more than they can give?
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. Eric Brandy, what do you say?
That's what my husband and I have been talking about since we read the book.
Yeah, yeah.
How much as a researher, how much are you obliged to give back?
Let's get from the source here, our own Margaret Mead in Mid-America. Sharon, thanks for the call. What do you say, Eric?
I wouldn't say that this qualifies as ethnography, really. I mean, I considered it more of a memoir, and there is a little bit of social science or a little bit of a scientific angle that I have at times. But I think she's right that certainly it would not work if hordes of people like me descended on communities like this in order to try to live a simpler life. It would be unrealistic. They would be flooded. And so I felt very fortunate. And you're right. I felt to some extent that my act could not be repeated indefinitely by others. It's something that can only be done very sparingly and discreetly.
But in the end, I guess, really your experiment turns out to be more about bringing out a kind of report on how life was or might be lived, some element of that. Neil is calling from New York City. Hi, Neil. You're on the air.
Hi. I was in Paris in June for 2 weeks with my wife's sister, and she and her husband are live a fairly simple lifestyle in the middle of this very modern metropolitan city. They don't have broadcast TV. They do play videos for their son to help him learn English. They don't have cell phones. They listen to the radio once in a while. My larger point is that you don't have to go Amish to not live a simpler life. You can. It's really a choice, I think.
And are they doing it because they're bohemian, because they don't have the money? They're clearly not Amish.
No, they do have the money. They are, in fact, practitioners of Buddhism, but they're very modern people.
They have
computers, which they use once in a while. They just don't really want the sort of technological information clutter in their lives. They do read the newspaper. They just don't feel the need to have the TV or radio or anything blasting all the time, and they'd rather not have it in their lives.
And your question for Eric Brandy?
Well, I mean, do you think that it's possible to make? I mean, I think a lot of us feel that we have this stuff imposed on us from outside. Do you feel that it really is that, or that it is an internal choice that comes from within, and that we, even in the middle of the technological society, not in an Amish place, can choose to live a more simplified life?
Got it, Neil. Thanks for your call. Eric, is the option there?
Oh, definitely, and that, I think, is exactly what my book points toward. I think it would be unrealistic for us, whether we try to descend on Amish communities or even onto rural America to try to suddenly live off the land. I would much rather see people in the city live a simpler life in the city and start to integrate those bodily and mental things that have been separated by technology.
But is it even possible? I mean, you describe, you know, almost the need to be out hoeing the earth. If you're not out doing it in a city, that's often not an option.
Well, New York City is an exception. I mean, to some extent, New York City is an incredibly densely populated city where people are stacked taller than they are in the horizontal plane. But I think in a lot of cities, it's more practical. In St. Louis, for example, which is still a major city of about 2.5 million in the metro area, we're only 2 miles from downtown, and yet we have a garden. And one wonderful touch is recently the neighbors across the alley from us got a rooster.
So you've got the cock-a-doodle-doo in the morning again.
Yes, we get the cock-a-doodle-doo. And we have a carriage house in the back. It was originally built for horse and buggy, and there's a hayloft on top that I'm going to turn into a little office for myself.
That maybe even still has a whiff of hay in it. I want to get one more call in here. Brian's on the line. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Yeah, it's interesting. I grew up in a more liberal Mennonite family, but I followed it weekly and went away from it, you know, looking for my riches. And
yes,
technology was part of discovering that a lot of what I grew up with didn't mesh with what I was getting out there. And I had a quick question for him, but first, one thing that I see, especially with technology, specifically media, is I think that's one of the biggest dangers. To not only, you know, the faith, but how they believe. The Mennonite Amish have very, what some people consider conservative values, but they don't mesh with a fundamentalism type of value, which is completely at odds with things like non-resistance.
And which may be flowing in over the media, but our time is short. And what's your question, Brian?
My question relating to that is knowing that he went through all this, I was kind of wanting to see what his spiritual outcome of this was. Was there a conversion there? Is he going to be Mennonite? Or
great, we've got it.
Not specifically that, but what is the spiritual outcome?
Yeah, let us take that away. And thanks for your call, Eric. You went in Catholic to a very non-Catholic environment, but spiritually, how did you come out?
Well, I think it was enriching spiritually. I think that if you read the book, you'll see that we were tugged. Our heartstrings were tugged by the community. We didn't go whole hog. We didn't join. We didn't become Mennonite. But I think that we are as Mennonite or Amish as a Catholic can possibly be today, at least in a city. And I think there's a lot of compatibility between the two religions because of the monastic tradition in Catholicism. There's a lot of similarities between how the Mennonites live and monastic communities live.
We've got just 20 seconds here. A lot of people are listening to you tonight, surrounded by the technology that you've walked away from. In a nutshell, what's your advice?
Well, I think you have to start, first of all, to create the contemplative conditions so you can quiet down your mind and discern more clearly the kinds of choices you have to make and separate your true needs from from the needs you merely think are your true needs. And everything will flow from that.
Eric Brendy, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Eric Brendy was more or less Amish for a year. His book is Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology. You can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. After the break, a conversation with 9/11 Commissioner Jamie Gorelick. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On Capitol Hill, Congress held hearings today on reforming the nation's intelligence community. Democrats questioned the president's plan to create a new national intelligence director and said his vision falls short. Members of the 9/11 Commission are now on national tour, beating the drum for their recommendations. Earlier today, I sat down with 9/11 Commissioner Jamie Gorelick. Jamie Gorelick, thanks for joining us on Point.
My pleasure.
President Bush has stood in the Rose Garden now and said that he's going to act on the main recommendations of the 9/11 Commission with a new central director of intelligence and a new central anti-counterterrorism center. Is he, in fact, delivering on what you've asked for?
Well, we embrace the support that he has given to two of our central organizational concepts. The devil is in the details, and those are yet to be worked out. We have, in our view, a need for a really strong national intelligence director with authority over the budgets of the other of the 15 agencies, with personnel authority and power. The concept as outlined may not have all of the powers that we would like to see, but we are sure that those kinds of issues can be addressed in the legislative process.
Let's look at some of the aspects of what President Bush and his staff have said about what he's planning to do. First of all, he said that this new National Intelligence Director, as he envisions it, would not be in the cabinet. In fact, would not be in the White House. The commission, 9/11 commission, said it should be in the executive office, or right next to the president, in effect. What do you make of that?
The reason that we made that recommendation is that we see how, at least potentially intransigent, the agencies that need to cooperate can be, and how difficult it is to corral all 15 agencies to get them really marching in the same direction. So we thought having proximity to the president was important. That can be done in many ways. We urged that the National Intelligence Director be part of the executive office of the president, but it could be in a freestanding agency as long as the president is firmly behind it.
Andrew Carr, the president's chief of staff, said yesterday that this new director would not have authority to hire or fire or control the budgets of those 15 intelligence agencies. What do you say to that?
That's not what we recommended, and we are hopeful that having embraced the concept, we can urge Congress and the president to give the National Intelligence Director the power that we think he or she needs. Right now, the director of Central Intelligence today has authority to advise on the budgets of the other agencies, has the authority today to advise on personnel, and clearly we found that to be lacking. The models of a drug czar or an energy czar, which are more coordinating functions, are not quite what we had in mind. So we are hopeful of engaging in a dialogue to strengthen this position.
But yet coordinating was the very word that President Bush used yesterday to describe the role of this new National Intelligence Director as he envisions it. You're saying coordination is not enough. What is the role that you'd like to see?
Well, coordination is very important, but the question is how you get to coordinate if you don't have levers, if you don't have the ability to say to an agency, if you don't do X, there is a consequence. And that's why we proposed a National Intelligence Director close to the president, of cabinet rank, but not in the cabinet itself, because it's not a policymaking job, with the authority over the budget, with hire and fire authority, with personnel policy setting authority. These are agencies that have grown up doing their own thing, and they need to sing off the same page.
The United States currently spends about $40 billion a year on intelligence, and 80% of that is controlled out of the Pentagon. You've worked in the Pentagon. You've watched this Pentagon, George Bush's, Donald Rumsfeld's Pentagon. Do you expect them to willingly give up their authority, their command, over that 80% of the intelligence budget and all that goes with it?
Most observers, and certainly almost all, if not all, of the witnesses who came before the commission on this subject, said that it is critically important to have the national intelligence interests supersede the interests of any one agency. Now, obviously, everyone wants to make sure that our military has the resources that it needs. But the balancing of resource needs has to be done by an individual outside of any one agency. If our tactical military needs, which is what has been soaking up so many of the resources, have permanently the first call on our intelligence resources across the board, then national needs like the need to understand an al-Qaeda and how it is operating will suffer. And that's why we suggest a national intelligence director who can ultimately not just advise on the budget, but have authority. Now, clearly, if the national intelligence director decides the budget ought to be X and it ought to be divided among the agencies in a given way, and the Secretary of Defense doesn't like that, the Secretary of Defense reports to the same boss. And ultimately, this is a presidential call. So we're not saying to give a single individual power over all of the Pentagon or power over the State Department or power over each of these other agencies without appeal.
Yet when Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld testified before your commission in March, he said that the creation of a new national intelligence director would do the nation, to quote him, a great disservice because it would tend to centralize intelligence. He said it should remain decentralized. Do you expect Donald Rumsfeld to try to stonewall this effort?
You know, it's interesting. In the beginning of the chapter where we discuss these recommendations, we quote Secretary Rumsfeld at great length in discussing how beneficial to the military it has been to have the Office of the Secretary of Defense over each of the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff to essentially create a unifying approach among different agencies.
Over military operations.
Yes, but that's a perfect analog in the sense that one could say, and people did say, the advocates for the Air Force, the advocates for the Army, the advocates for the Navy said, oh, it will be terrible if we have someone who is controlling our budget from outside, if we have someone who is making personnel policies for us that we have to abide by. Secretary Rumsfeld himself brought that analog to us and said it may be that in the greater good, agencies are going to have to give up some turf. Secretary Rumsfeld has been around for a very long time. He knows how governments work and don't. And I have every confidence that in the end we will have a good, strong debate about this and we will end up in a good place.
All the commissioners are out on the road now, including yourself, selling it for all it's worth, trying to drive home the importance of it. Do you think that Washington is responding on an appropriate timetable here? How quickly, optimally, would this consideration and enactment of a new structure take place?
It's interesting that Tom Kaine and Lee Hamilton testified right after the rollout of our report last Friday, before, of course, the most recent threat information was announced. And they said quite pointedly, the threat is there. We are not organized optimally to meet the threat. Our policies need to be changed, and these changes need to be approached with great urgency.
Jimmy Gorelick, the 9/11 Commission labored mightily to maintain its bipartisan front through all those 20 months. I want to ask, how hard was that? And can that be maintained in a wider Washington? Can it be maintained in a presidential election year where the two candidates are already trading pretty sharp barbs over how the other imagines America's intelligence structure?
We were appointed in a highly partisan town, in a highly partisan moment, by partisans. Five Democrats, five Republicans. Tom Kaine has said the structure was set up to fail. We are motivated by that same unity of purpose that the country had on the evening of September 11th. We came together as a country. We are not together now as a country. The commission felt it was critically important to the country's safety that we come out with unanimous recommendations and that we find the facts unanimously. And we did, not by lopping off the hard questions, but by discussing them in a mutually respectful way. We had the benefit of having the charge of finding the facts. And so we hewed to those facts. We looked at documents. We listened to witnesses. And we discussed those issues among ourselves. We think that this can be a model for others in our government. It could be a model for our Congress. We had both a bipartisan and a nonpartisan staff, and we dealt with each other in a concentrated way on the merits with this greater unity of purpose. I would hope that where our national security is involved, that not only can the commission resist the political maelstrom, but that our national security policymakers do the same.
Do you think that the presidential campaign makes urgent reform more or less likely?
Both.
What do you mean?
Well, we would have preferred to have issued our report after the election so that it would be less of a political football. But that was not to be. Congress very much wanted us to have our report done by the end of July, and we decided to try to turn lemons into lemonade by making sure that we were unanimous, by telling the country that we were going to hit the road, as we are doing today and which we will be doing into the future, by encouraging public debate on the merits, by giving this example of a bipartisan approach. And what we have now is a healthy competition between the political parties to adopt, embrace, consider our recommendations. We think that's great.
As you sat through those many months of testimony, some of it the public has heard, much of it the public has not, did you have, Jamie Gorelick, a kind of oh my God moment when the problem unfolded to you in a way that was dramatic and clear, the problem with America's intelligence and national security?
There were several. There were several. I'll give you just one or two. We had a hearing several months ago in which we had as a witness the head of security and intelligence for the Federal Aviation Administration, whose job it is to make sure that the policies and procedures of the FAA match up against the threat. We asked him when he came to realize that the FAA's no-fly list of people who are not permitted to fly on airplanes because they're threats to civil aviation, with approximately 20 names on it, didn't have the benefit of the State Department's list of possible terrorists, which has 60,000 names on it. And he answered that question yesterday. He came to realize that the day before he testified, so that even 2 years after 9/11, he was not aware that there was elsewhere in our intelligence apparatus a tool that could have been hugely useful to the FAA in protecting civil aviation.
With thousands of names unknown to the FAA at that time.
That's right. That was a stunning moment to us. There were many others.
And very briefly, your perceptions of some of the top government officials who testified before you, Condoleezza Rice.
She was an impressive witness. She had command of the facts. She kept her wits about her in a circus-like environment.
Her level of candor?
She didn't always answer all of the questions as fully as I would have liked, but I thought she was an impressive witness.
Richard Clark.
Well, Richard Clark threw a Molotov cocktail in the middle of our hearing. We had no idea that his book was going to come out when it did. We had no idea that he was going to apologize to the families as he did. We had no idea that he had the views he had about the decision to invade Iraq being a detriment to our counterterrorism efforts. And it certainly increased public attention to the hearings, which was a good thing. But it did momentarily threaten our bipartisanship, which we eventually regained.
And finally, George Bush and Dick Cheney appearing together before the commission.
The suggestion that there would be ventriloquism was not borne out by the testimony. They answered the questions fully. Each one of them answered the questions that were put to them. Both President Bush and former President Clinton were very impressive witnesses, and they answered our questions, as did the Vice President and former Vice President Gore.
So you got what you thought you needed from the nation's top leaders there.
We did.
Jamie Gorelick, it looks like you're going to be on the road for a while along with your other commissioners. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Jamie Gorelick serves on the bipartisan 9/11 Commission. She spoke with me today in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.